Welcome to 2500 Del Monte Street, the oral history of Tower Records. Today's guest is Rick Dorsey. To the podcast. So let's say you work for a company you love for almost 19 years. That company goes out of business. You quickly hook up with another company full of very good people, but it's not exactly the same, and soon enough you realize that your new company is about to go through the same things the original company went through. That happened to me, and it happened to my guest today, Rick Dorsey. Rick worked for Tower Records throughout Los Angeles for 20 years. I worked for Tower just shy of 19 years. When Tower Records went out of business, we both went to work for Borders Books, which was based out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. I didn't know Rick while I was at Tower, though I certainly knew of him. It was a Borders Books Managers Conference where I was introduced to Rick Dorsey by Mike Redman, another Tower to Borders Books manager. At that conference, I remember sitting at a table talking to Rick and Mike Redman and Kevin Ertel, and we just sat there one evening talking about our time at Tower Records. When I was putting this podcast together, one of the people who jumped in completely from the get-go was Rick Dorsey. He frequently texts me after episodes telling me what he liked about that particular week's guest. I think after Rick's episode, people will be texting me about what they like about Rick. Please enjoy. All right, at this time, please welcome to the podcast, Rick Dorsey. Rick, welcome.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Hey, nice to see you. So just to kind of let people know, Rick is one of those folks that while we worked at Tower Records, I didn't really know him. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is we both had to lose our jobs at Tower, go work for Borders Books, meet up at the Borders conventions and sit in the corner with a couple other ex-Tower people and just talk about Tower. So hopefully the Borders folks didn't know what we were talking about, but I always thought that was kind of funny. Rick, I'm happy to have you here. We're gonna start off where we start with everybody, and let's talk about the role that music played in your life at an early age. What are your memories of music in your family, and how did it come to be all consuming for you?
And that's, you know, hitting the nail on the head. All consuming. And it still is in a certain capacity, you know, today. There's nothing more exciting than discovering new music and realizing you missed something and sort of rediscovering it. You think you've got a deep catalog of like a phonolog in your head of songs and artists, and everyone always likes to, when you're at family gatherings or with the friends that weren't at Tower, you know, well, who did this song or who did that? You know, oh, Rick will know, right? And over time, I start to get nervous that, am I forgetting
stuff? Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, from a really, really early age, I was just fascinated with music. There was always music playing in the house. Either classical music or music from different parts of the world, because my parents often had students from different parts of the world living with us as they were doing their ESL, English as a Second Language, classes. My mother was in that field in education. And so I was exposed to a lot of different sounds. Plus, my parents traveled a lot, and my dad liked to bring records back. So that was some of my early experiences being exposed to different sounds. And of course, I had my faves, but I didn't really pay attention to it as seriously in maybe my early years as I did in high school, where it just became that escape, and your go-to friend that was always there for you. And maybe at a certain point you sort of aligned yourself with groups of people that listened to the same things you listened to, and you wanted to be listening to something that wasn't mainstream. I think I learned early on, although I had an appreciation for mainstream hits of the day, I certainly identified more with music that was aligned with certain groups of people. You know, we all separated into groups in high school, and that's where music really, really started to latch on. And being in the proximity of where I live to LA and Hollywood, just being outside of the LA basin and out in the suburbs, it was pretty easy to go to shows. And there were lots and lots of clubs. We were really clever with X-Acto blades and our driver's licenses. Back then you could cut them up. You could take your address and put it into your age. And we did this really just to be able to have fake IDs to get in to see the shows, not to party and drink and do all the stuff we shouldn't be doing, but it just to hear the music and see the bands that we wanted to see. And quite often we didn't even have money. My friends and I, we just talked our way in sometimes to places, or you hang around in the right place at the right time. And next thing you know, someone's like, "Hey, come on in," you know, and that right place at the right time seems to be kind of a story of my life when I came on board with Tower Records.
Well, let's step back for a second. So
yeah.
A 14, 15, 16 year old Rick Dorsey, what is he listening to, and how are you finding out about this music?
Okay. I had an older sister, and she went through, probably when I was still listening to Billy Joel and maybe some more of the mainstream artists, she was bringing home Sex Pistols and Clash and Ramones records.
How much older was your sister?
You know, she was only a year older.
Uh-huh.
But she sort of was the rebel and had this double life almost, you know,
right.
where I was the school kid getting all the things done that my parents expected, and she seemed to be doing that, but in reality she was out all the time and doing stuff, and
yeah,
and I wasn't as brave as her till later, but but yeah, she turned me on to certain things that I thought were just dramatically different than what I was hearing on the radio. You know, the Ramones, Rocket to Russia and Road to Ruin. I mean, I could not stop playing those records.
Yeah.
And yeah. Nothing else that people I knew were listening to sounded anything like that. And I remember not even being able to get friends to, "Hey, check this out." You know, they were like, "Oh, what?" You know, yeah. Until I got into the right groups of friends, you know. But so, you know, all over the place, but as tends to happen when you enjoy one artist, maybe you're reading something about that artist, and then they mention another artist that you never heard of, and you say, "Well, you know, I like Joey Ramone, and he's talking about, this other artist that Talking Heads or Blondie, and like, what's that all about?" You know,
yeah.
So then you go exploring. Yeah.
So were you, in addition to being into the music and being into the club, were you also immersed in reading the music magazines, the Cream, Rolling Stone, New Music Express, that stuff at all?
No, not really. That came later. Yeah, I think there was a magazine in LA. I don't even know if it's still around. It was called the LA Weekly, and that was given out free everywhere.
Yeah.
And it always had music articles. But
going through, we had the city paper here, and it's like if you look at those old issues, the best thing is looking at the ads for the clubs. It's amazing to see who opened for who, and in these tiny little venues. But yeah, I'm totally aware of the LA Weekly.
That's how we'd map out our plans for the, probably about my junior year of high school is when I really got brave and was with a group of friends that were equally crazy. And that's when we really started hitting the clubs. And it was just at first, maybe a weekend here and there. And then it became obsessive. It was like weekly. And then it was Saturdays and Fridays. And then Thursdays. And then, you figured out which clubs allowed what during the week. And certain bands were always going to be like staples, like house bands almost.
So give me a rundown of give me a handful of the bands that you were going to see at this time.
Yeah. Oingo Boingo, which was a pretty staple band here to see on a weekly basis. Stray Cats. A lot of those 80 bands that some went on to attention and some really didn't. The Untouchables for like an LA band that I was really fond of, but didn't really amount to much beyond the LA area.
Right.
And then of course all the punk bands, those were the ones that were the easiest to see, the Fear and Agent Orange and X. Now I'm on the spot here. I'm drawing blanks of some of the bands, and certain bands that would just show up, that you weren't expecting. So if I went to see a band that I was looking for, and then whoa, you got a surprise act that you weren't expecting to run into, and double prizes, right?
Yeah. That's great. How about do you remember like the first record you bought with your money, your own money?
Yeah, the first record I bought was a Stevie Wonder 45, and it was a curious 45 because it had three or four tracks, three for sure, possibly a fourth, which I don't remember ever finding anywhere. I was in Mexico. And I bought it in a record store. I was out shopping with one of my uncles for something else. And we ended up in a record store and he said, "Oh, get whatever you want." And I remember seeing Sir Duke was a pretty hot song in the era. So gosh, I had to be, Sir Duke, that's really odd. I must've been really young when that came out. And I remember that I had the picture sleeve, which was a variation, I think, of the Intervisions cover, Intervisions album. I could be getting this totally wrong, but that's my recollection.
Yeah. No, I know.
So that song was on there, and had two great tracks on the B side or side two.
Yeah.
Which I can't recall at all what they were, but it was a really cool record that I know I still have to this day. I probably have enough 45s to light up a couple of jukeboxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Oh yeah. I was obsessed with 45s and picture sleeves, and it didn't dawn on me till even much later in life how cool picture sleeves were.
Well, that, it's funny you say that because that was what initially drew me to shopping at Tower. There were other places, in the DC area, you really had to drive in and find parking, and there were other places, but Tower A carried them on the release date, B had the picture discs, or excuse me, the picture sleeves, and then to get the unreleased B-sides, that was gold.
Yeah.
That was gold, so I'm sure you probably...
I bought Elton John's Philadelphia Freedom, and then years later, whoa, the B-side has Elton
John. I saw her standing there.
Yeah. And I was like,
John doing a Paul song.
Right. And the little words he says before they dive into the song, it's just precious,
Yeah. That's pretty amazing stuff. How about the first album? Do you remember the first album you bought with your own money?
Not really, because I didn't buy albums as much because I had a lot of albums. My dad seemed to constantly give me albums, and so did my older sister. She would buy stuff just to, like, it was a status thing that she had it and that she never listened to. She just handed it to me. You know, so I seemed to be amassing a great collection without ever actually going out to buy them. Later, it was, you know, just like going to concerts every weekend, I was going to record swap meets, just looking for stuff that I had to find and couldn't find anywhere else.
And what tell me about the culture of the LA swap meets, because we had some, I guess they called them record conventions here, and they were okay, but you know, in places like New York City and Los Angeles, it must have been a real thing, and especially with the music business, you know, being right there in Los Angeles. Talk a little bit about that.
There were quite a few. Pasadena always had the best ones. It was outside the Rose Bowl, and it was outdoors, and
vinyl outdoors in the heat.
I know, right? And and nobody had like the easy ups or anything like that. This was out there in the open.
Right? Wow. Okay.
But that's when you learned how to care for your records. You know, they had those extra covers, and they had cleaners, and you know, things that showed you how to treat things properly.
Yeah.
What I thought was unique is I never really saw anybody my age there. It was really older folks.
Yeah.
And other collectors and people that could tell you stories, you know, and people that had just vast knowledge of music.
Yeah. I always liked the tables where the guys would carry the promo posters. Cause that was, I mean, you know, if you knew somebody at a record store, you could maybe ask for a poster, you know, when it came down 6 months from now, but you know, to come across and see posters you'd never see. I remember seeing Elvis Costello Armed Forces posters that, you know, blew me away, or the Clash, or things like the Clash Rolling Stone cover with you know, Joe and Mick on the front and stuff like that. That stuff always blew me away.
Yeah, you'd never know what you'd find at the record swaps. I remember finding a Fishbone demo cassette. So
really?
They hadn't been signed yet. And they had this cassette they were shopping around. And I thought, how did this end up here? And I remember I probably paid $3 for it or something. And it was heavy. And I thought, what kind of cassette did they use here? You know, but it played on your tape deck, and it had tracks that didn't get released till much later in their career.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Which was super cool. And they were, and the versions were, of course, were rough takes.
Yeah.
You know, they're not the final mixes, and that's precious. I always, you know, it's funny because Dirty Walt was a horn player in Fishbone, and his son goes to the school I work at. So I would talk to him about his dad's shows back when I was his age.
You know? Right. Right. Yeah.
And one of these days I should ask him if he wants that cassette.
You know? Yeah. Oh yeah. That's great. So at this time you're hitting record swaps and you're hitting record stores. At what point did you become aware of and start shopping at Tower?
Tower was definitely always on the radar. That was when you had some money and some serious time, and you know, you could stroll in there late hours, and you know, I think I'd been to the Hollywood Sunset Tower once or twice while I was out in that area, maybe waiting for a show at the Whiskey. And but the one that I ended up working at, which was near my home, was West Covina. So way out in the suburbs, but it was just this massive building, and there was nothing, no other record store that was anywhere close to the size of this place. It was just so huge.
When it was West Covina standalone?
Yeah. Standalone.
Okay. Yeah.
It was a former department store turned into Campus Life haunted houses every annually. It was an empty building. It was owned by the Sears company, which I think made it kind of a unique building because Sears is out of Illinois, somewhere in Illinois. And it seemed like it was a forgotten piece of property. So I remember, this is much later when I'm running the place,
yeah,
and looking at the rent going, this is like a house payment. No wonder this place makes so much money, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember Westwood was something astronomical, like $30,000 a month for rent there. And here was West Covina, it was like $900. You know, it was like,
are you serious?
Oh yeah. It was like ridiculously small. God.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did they even know what they have here? You know,
I wonder why Sears went out of business. Anyway, we're talking about why we went out of business. So do you remember at what point did you apply for a job?
Sure. Yeah. I was, I was working weird jobs like restaurants and even the criminal division of the municipal courthouse, and thinking about a career in a law degree or something, a career in law. But I seemed to find myself at that Tower store more and more. And even closer to me was a Music Plus store. So I thought, you know, this is more realistic. I'm embarrassed to say this, Bob, but I had a Vespa. Okay. A scooter.
Yeah.
That's how I got around.
Okay.
We're, you know, like Quadrophenia. All the
I was going to say you're a mod.
I literally said, I'm a rude boy, right? I wanted to differentiate myself with the kids who had more money to spend for nicer clothes. Right.
So, yeah.
But I had a scooter with the chrome and the mirrors and it was my pride and joy. I rode that thing everywhere. Absurd vehicles, absolutely absurd vehicles. But I thought, okay, that's more reliable. And Music Plus hired me, and I had applied at Tower, never heard from them. But the day I was scheduled to start my first shift at Music Plus, Tower Records called, and I never showed up at Music Plus. And I said, I just was a no-show on day one.
Wow.
And never called them or anything. I was just like, you know,
yeah.
Starry-eyed, I'm going to Tower, right? And then they weren't even offering me a job. It was just an interview. Yeah.
So what do you remember about getting hired, and who was store manager? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was Rodney Metoyer was the assistant store manager at the time. And I believe Bob Federal was the store manager, but he was on vacation. And so Rodney was doing some of the hiring, and, you know, Bob will have the story better because he swears that he hired me, but okay. Rodney swears that he hired me. And I thought I remember it would be in Rodney. And I think I was with a group of people that we all got hired at the same time. And it was literally maybe a 5-minute interview and then start your shift now, you know?
So, oh, really?
That's yeah, just quickly. Just thrown out there.
Gotcha.
And I remember there was a test, but they didn't give me the test, but I saw it later and I thought it was ridiculous. I thought it was a test that was kind of snobby. And
now several people have talked about the test in the LA stores.
Yeah. And I didn't know all the answers at all, but there was a place where you could write your own thoughts. And I wrote something about how important it was, like a little essay paragraph, and how important music was to me, and even more important at the time than my girlfriend, who I'm now married to. Right. And I remember to this, you know, Bob would hold that against me all the time. He's like, you know, I'm going to show her this, you know? So,
wow.
Yeah. That was like his little blackmail on me.
Yeah.
Like, do what I say, or I'm going to show her this, what you wrote here.
Right. Oh my God.
So it's funny. But yeah, that's.
And so what positions did you hold there? You obviously started out as a clerk. Where'd you go from there?
Clerk. And you maybe have a similar experience where it was so much fun. I never left. Like, my shift I would get there before it started and it ended and I was still there, you know?
Yeah.
So I really was just, I can't remember if I made it up to a shift supervisor there or not. I think I did. But I must have. That's all fuzzy though. but then Anita Bond, had worked there previously. She left for something, I can't remember what, and then she'd come back, and I think Rodney had moved to there. All of a sudden there were all these stores opening in Southern California, so there was demand for more talent, and,
right,
and I think Rodney had moved over to run Anaheim, and Anita was going to be taking the store manager position in Westwood. And she asked me to go as her assistant store manager. So it was a real short time, I think, in any kind of shift supervisor role. And then boom, I was assistant manager. Had no idea what I was doing, you know, but I wanted to support Anita, who really was, you know, Bob and Anita were just massive influences on, on, on me and on trying to do a good job and be a better, better tower person. I owe so much to both of them.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. So you went to Westwood as assistant manager to Anita.
Right. That was in 89.
Okay.
And then,
Tell me about the Westwood store.
Oh, Westwood was fantastic. So you're in the Westwood Village, the heart of UCLA, and the West Side. So you're surrounded by Beverly Hills, Brentwood, Bel Air, and that whole Wilshire, you know, community, pretty affluent. And you're bombarded with high profile customers, you know, that was an adjustment, you know, to suddenly realize that you know, the guy asking you for a blues, album is Nicolas Cage, or the person putting their hand out to be taken to where the jazz cassettes are is Rita Moreno, you know, and you're helping someone out to their car and it's the famous playwright Neil Simon, you know, so there's just a never ending parade of people in the either music industry or motion picture industry or television industry. And it was a super high profile location, though it was not Sunset.
Right.
It was almost, I remember George Harrison telling me one day that he prefers shopping.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
I remember one day George Harrison telling me, anybody who starts a sentence like that is, is blessed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's literally one of the best quotes I've heard since I started the podcast. So I apologize for interrupting, but go on. Tell me what George Harrison told you.
George said, and you're right. It's such a blessing that at the time you didn't even realize it.
Right. You know? Right.
But he would tell me that he preferred coming into Westwood to browse through the record store than Sunset because nobody would bother him.
Yeah.
He could be in Westwood for hours and nobody would bat an eye. They had no idea it was him. Maybe you'd call them the groupies, the autograph seekers, the paparazzi that was always hanging around.
Oh, you did have a little bit of that.
No, not really.
Oh,
not,
you didn't.
But not like Sunset did.
Sunset did. Gotcha. I got right. you. Yeah. So quickly, just off the top of your head, and you got to answer both parts. Give me a couple of your favorite, nicest celebs that shopped your store, and a couple nasty ones.
I can't really say there were any nasty ones.
Demanding.
I would say stressful.
Okay, you know, that's a good word.
If Michael Jackson's coming, there's going to be stress, even when you think he's happy. You'll get some phone calls after, but something that wasn't right, you know.
So, just walk me through a situation. So, do they call you in advance? Say Michael's coming.
Yeah, Michael, for the most part, would not he himself, although sometimes him, but mostly he had his liaison was Marlon Brando's son, Miko Brando.
Yeah.
Super nice guy, and Miko would call and say, you know, Michael's got. Planning to come by, can we arrange, you know, maybe he'd come in after hours,
right?
Although sometimes he might just pop in the middle of the day and you just never knew, but you know, for the most part the visit was pretty congenial. You know, he had his peculiarities. He'd show up with a limo full of kids, you know, but there were always chaperones too. So none of that seemed weird to me. I mean, right. Michael to me was just another one of those kids.
Right.
You know, talking to Michael is like talking to Peter Pan. You know, it's exactly what you imagine talking to Michael Jackson would be like.
Yeah. And what year is this approximately?
This would be 90 through early 90s.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't take over Westwood till 92. So, okay. You know, most of the times I encountered him, Anita was the store manager. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure she had a lot more stress than I did.
Where was the stress involved? I mean, we're talking about somebody coming in shopping. Like somebody else told me about Michael coming into the store and asking for one James Brown song to be played on a loop for a half an hour.
You know, or if he's going to buy Abbey Road, he would buy every copy we had. You know, he'd push a shopping cart through the store and just throwing stuff into the shopping cart, you know, and all the staff wanted to work, right? Because if you wanted something, just throw it in the shopping cart. Michael's going to buy it for you. Yeah. You know? So all those holes you weren't supposed to have came out of the woodworks and into Michael's basket, right?
Right, right.
But for instance, the year his goodness, what's the name of the album? I don't know why I'm thinking the album is called Dangerous.
Okay.
And you can imagine Westwood. It's a high profile location. It's got a street facing window, display window. That window is full of Dangerous. You walk in the front door, first end cap hits you with a massive end cap sign on it, Dangerous. As you enter the store further, there's a large wall that spans three stories, and it's got a room for four or five displays, but instead it's one giant Dangerous display.
Gotcha.
Then there's railings that cover the second floor of the mezzanine, the third floor, and these railings can have displays. All that is Dangerous. So Michael comes in, he sees all that, he leaves, and suddenly we're getting phone calls. It's the label, it's the marketing department, it's promotions, it's management, and then it's the regional office, then it's the home office. Michael wasn't happy. What are you guys doing down there? And it's like, what more could we possibly do? You know.
But he doesn't say anything to Anita.
No, to you, he's congenial. He's, you know, hello, and you know, here's a copy of the album, and a nice, pleasant visit, but you're on your toes because, you know, what could he possibly find that he didn't like, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. But, you know.
Anybody else stressful?
Not that I could think of.
Who are some of your favorites?
Some of my favorites. I mean, all the guys from Los Lobos, they would come in.
That's amazing.
You know, with the whole family guys pushing strollers, you got the wives, the kids, the tias, all the whole family is coming in, you know, and they're just so approachable. And so
that's great.
You know, and you know, how about this one, Bob? Mike Tyson. Okay. He was such a lovable, nice, friendly person who would come in and when he had his caretakers, his entourage. But he loved to talk, and he loved to, he called me a little Bobby De Niro. He said, you got to slick your hair back. And then he would ask me to do the, you know,
right. Yeah.
Wise guy type of expressions for him. He invited me to go to Vegas when he had his brand new black Lamborghini parked in front of the store. He's like, Rick, I'll let you drive it around the block. You got to try it. It's great. He's like, let's go to Vegas for the weekend. I just need to do a few things. And I'm like, I just couldn't picture calling my wife and say, I'll be back on Monday. I'm going with Mike to Vegas, you know?
Wow.
And, you know, stuff like, but you know, someone would ask him to sign something and he would sign anything he wanted to sign. One guy, I remember, he said, I've got a videotape of you at home, a VHS tape. It's like great boxing moments or something.
Right.
Can I run home and get it? And Mike's like, yeah. You know, and he sat on the stairs in the store waiting for about an hour and a half for this guy to come back. And then he signed it for him.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, Michael, you want some lunch or something?
That's awesome. I think you told me too, didn't you? Wasn't OJ one of your customers?
Yeah. OJ was definitely the high speed chase, right, with him and Al Cowling occurred. But the day before that occurred, he and Al were in the store and Al was looking for a song, you know, and I found it on that Muse machine, right? And
do you know what the song was?
Jerry Doggett's Honky Tonk.
Okay.
Nice little it's actually an R&B number.
Yeah.
Great song. And Al gave me, he said, when you find it, give me a call. I'll come down and get it. And literally the next day was the high speed chase.
Did you get approached by police?
No.
Okay. Sometimes they,
I did with a Michael incident years later, but
oh really?
Yeah. And journalists. Oh my gosh. Journalists were always calling, you know, who would always, Jamie Lee Curtis was, a regular, there in Westwood. And she wanted the Pajama Game original Broadway cast recording. And so she had given me her number and she said, give me a call when you get it in, and had that number in right there in Anita's Rolodex forever.
Right.
You know, and somehow the word got out and there were a couple LA DJs that were desperately trying to get in touch with her, and they were calling like, we hear you've got her number, you know, and I'm like, how does this get out? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then I didn't give it to them.
Yeah. So you talked about the famous people who shop there. Talk to me about the staff that you worked with. Who were some of your all-stars, the people that you leaned on, the people that, you know, made things happen in your store?
There were so many. In Westwood, you know, I had an incredible resources. We had a classical store down the street. I had a bunch of UCLA ex-professors, guys with their masters and doctorates who just love classical music, and they, you know, held court down there, and they were phenomenal. The classical buyer, Eric Warwick, was just a genius. Our jazz buyer, Julie Remick, any single jazz artist coming to town would come in to see Julie.
Really? That's amazing.
They'd even stop their shows and say, is that you, Julie Remick, screaming up there? You know, Anita Baker stopped her show at the Greek to say hi to Julie.
Oh my God.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar would just, you know, she would just lead him around the jazz section. He'd have his arms out and she'd just load him up with albums.
So can I let you know that everyone always associates Elton John as our greatest customer. I've done more of these podcast interviews and Kareem gets mentioned as shopping in our jazz department more than any. And when I was at Lincoln Center, he was in there. He would help other customers who didn't know who he was find stuff because he knew where everything was. But it's just so funny how, you know, the people in the stores know what a hardcore jazz fan and what a great customer he was of ours.
Yeah, you know, he would come in the front door, and we had, you know, two sets of stairs to get to the third level where the jazz was. And those stairs, you know, take you a good 30, 40 seconds to get up those flights of stairs. And Kareem, it'd be like 3 seconds, you know, and he's up there.
Yeah.
And that was always marvel to watch him move up those stairs.
Right. Yeah.
When my son was born, you know, Kareem was notorious for not really wanting to sign autographs.
Right.
Not when he's shopping. Right. Yep. But when my son was born, you know, my wife was a real hardcore Laker fan. We'd go to all the games there, as many as we could at the Forum and during the Showtime years. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to give her a really nice gift. I'm going to ask Kareem to sign one of his, Tops, you know, basketball cards, dedicated to my son. Right. But I'd never asked him to sign anything before. I never asked anybody to sign things.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just seemed
you just didn't do it.
Yeah. It just seemed like inappropriate. But I remember he was checking out, he was working with Julie, and I came up to him and I literally just said, "Hey Cap, how's it going?" And he turns and he goes, "What do you want signed?" <You know? laughs> And I said, "Oh, you know, well, you know, my son was born. I wonder if you could dedicate a card to." He's all, "Yeah." And handed the card. He's like, "To Adrian, you know, Kareem."
Oh, that's awesome.
And then I hand him another card and he goes, "Well, who do you want this one signed to?" And I said, "No, that one's for you." And he's like, "For me?" And Bob, somewhere I had heard, if you ever ask a sports figure to sign a card, have two and give them the other one so they can sell it somewhere.
Really?
And I said, "Well, that one's for you. So you can," and as the words are leaving my mouth, I'm like, "This sounds like the stupidest thing ever." And I'm like, "So you can sell it somewhere." He's like, "That's the dumbest thing I ever heard." So who do you want this one signed? So I had him sign it to my wife.
Right? Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So at what point did you become a store manager?
My first day as store manager was in May of 1992. And I was welcomed by the LA riots. So we never even opened the doors. We were getting boarded up. Because the night before, all hell had already broken loose.
Yeah.
And curiously, OJ was in the store the day before, and people were asking him, "What do you think's going to happen, OJ?" He's like, "I'm just praying for peace in the streets," you know. And we were getting bomb threat phone calls. We were getting all kinds of weird calls that were coming to burn you down. And that night, nothing really took place in our store, but a lot of stores in the village got ransacked. The warehouse. I came in the next morning, the warehouse, all their product was all over Westwood Boulevard. Mm. And I was horrified. I was like, oh my gosh. And we got boarded up. And I remember it took me about 5 hours to get home that day because there was so much turmoil and trying to cross LA.
Yeah.
To get home. Yeah. Mm. I put my Jeep Wrangler in four wheel drive and I was, it was an adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I was in Seattle at the time and I remember, things were spreading up the coast. There were people were marching in the city, which is just something we kind of in our lifetime, except for in the '60s when we're little kids, we're not actively watching that, but yeah, I distinctly remember that happening. I remember hearing about it in Portland. It was happening in Seattle. They were stopping the traffic. But you guys were at ground zero. You were right in the middle of it.
I was in bright sunshine in Westwood, but I went into complete darkness in LA proper and then back to sunshine in the San Gabriel Valley where I lived.
Yeah.
It was almost impossible to explain.
Yeah. Yeah. So beyond that is your start date.
That was my first day as store manager.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to me about some of the highlights of your time running Westwood.
I certainly enjoyed all the attention that Westwood got. You could get really power crazy because you were offered everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever, any show you wanted to go to, any backstage, any dinner with the artists, you want to see a play, you want to see a movie screen, you want whatever you want, you could have as all at your fingertips. That kind of gets exhausting after a while, especially if you're starting a new family and right. You have other commitments. But that was a really nice perk. You always got a lot of support. I thought the home office was always great. I remember Russ coming down one time because our rent was astronomical and they wanted to work with this landlord who didn't want to work with anybody. And I remember Russ, he said, let's go get some pop, right? We're going to go get a soda pop across the street. And, and we're sitting in a restaurant and he's like, Rick, what do you think we should do with Westwood? And I'm like, I don't think I'm qualified to answer that question. And he goes, that cashier you got there that you just hired, that your front register there? He goes, he can make that decision. So you are qualified. I'm like, okay. That's how really special I felt like he was with all of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the seeing the village transition from being a real hotspot in the 80s where they closed off the streets because there was so much walking traffic. And on Friday nights, our store was just impossibly packed with people. Mm-hmm. Those were some glory years to go through that. And that store had Leslie Painter was manager there. Chris Hobson was manager there. Of course, Anita. That store wore you out. It was a lot of pressure. Even though it did a fraction of the business the West Covina store did.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if I think a lot of the memories they come and go of good times, but I really really like that store.
Yeah. Yeah. How about like, did you guys do any in-stores? I mean, obviously most of them, the big high profile ones, I'm sure went to Sunset, but did you guys do any?
Yeah, we had our share. We did, everything from, I remember we had Jeff Buckley.
Oh man.
And he wanted to be a Tower employee. So I made him a name tag. And I filmed that performance. So I have it on a little digital video.
Yeah. Yeah.
He passed away a short time after that.
Right.
That was a phenomenal in-store. Then you get some disposable heroes of hypocrisy, right? Michael Franti.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They were
real energetic.
Television.
We did some book signings with Marianne Faithfull and a lot of up and coming developing artists, I'd have to look in my, I wrote things down. I kept a journal. I have to breeze through there to see what other, a lot of acts just came through there too. The Capitol rep would come through and say, hey, we just signed these guys. They're called Radiohead, and want to show them what a record store in the US looks like,
Yeah.
a lot of Sublime. When they put their first record out, they had it on Skunk Records. They came by and I took it in on consignment, right? And it was just a 3-song CD. And lo and behold, they had this interesting song called Date Rape. And like 2 weeks later, the radio station was K-Rock was testing the song, and it just blew up and boom, you know, I'm like, hey, we had them first.
The only guys who had it.
Yeah. Wow. And but really a bunch of nice guys, you know, they just like, hey, we got this record. Everybody had the record that was going to be the next best thing since, you know, sliced bread. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're running this high profile store. You talk about the pressure that's on it and stuff. How about stepping back a moment? Any memories from when we had the Tower annual conventions, the TAX? It was the one opportunity to, you know, get to the main office and interact with the people that we, you know, traded emails with or phone calls with or stuff like that. But it was, you know, in Stan's words, it was just a good big party, getting everybody together. But any specific memories you have of that?
Yeah, they were so enjoyable.
Yeah.
I think we learned a few things too. I think we learned how special the company was, because you had managers from all over the country and then all over the world.
Yeah.
And so many, they didn't speak the same language, but they spoke the same music and love of Tower Records and
yeah,
the love of Russ and what he was doing and being part of that. And it was one of those things, you wanted to take back that euphoria to the rest of your team. And it was just so hard to translate that. But those were really special, special times. I remember Andy Lown. not sure how he and I connected, but we hit it off right away. And oh, I know how I had to babysit him and is it Jason or Josh, his assistant manager? They were in LA and I had to babysit them for a weekend.
Really?
and take them to different places. I call it babysitting. Andy will call it something differently.
Yeah. Tour guide.
Yeah. And I remember we ended up at a big Audio Dynamite show at the Palladium. But before the show, we had dinner with the guys, the band, at the Cat and Custard Cup or something like that. And during our moment where we're all taking a big photo together, my glasses fell off and Mick Jones stepped on them and broke them. And I was like, okay, I'm blind the rest of the night, but let's go to the Palladium, you know? And
yeah.
Oh, sorry, mate. Oh, yeah, we'll get that fixed for you.
Oh, wow.
And then I remember being just, you know, probably a little too inebriated after the show, and we couldn't find my car, and I don't even know how we got back to their hotel. So Andy and I, hit it off, and so at the Tower conventions, we'd look for each other. And I remember going to Goman's house one time at that convention, and Goman opening the door saying, "Oh, Dorsey, I've got this tequila you got to try." You know, and then from there, we missed all the shuttles back to the hotel, so we took Stan's car. And Andy was driving, and he's like, he didn't know how to drive in the U.S. very well.
Yeah, you're on the wrong side.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, cool. How about... Yeah, I mean, you talked about Russ coming and visiting, and obviously it was probably a pretty regular thing in that area for him to visit. Any other thoughts you have about, you know, kind of what he created and what he made available to us, and just any kind of inspiration maybe you took from him as the leader of Tower?
You know, so many things that over the years that I attribute to his style. Everything from bring yourself, bring who you are to work, and believing in your team and the best managers are the ones that put together teams of people that are stronger than them, you know, and and make you look good because you've got such a great team that does everything, and the importance of supporting others and helping develop them. When you thought an idea might be good, and you'd call up, you literally could just call up Stan or Russ and say, you know, what do you think about this? And they would be literally like, if you think it's a good idea, then I think it's a good idea. Let's try it. You know?
Yeah. I try to explain that to people, and they're kind of like, oh, well, you know, you were probably told that you could, but you wouldn't really do that. It's like, no, we could pick up the phone and call the guy who owned the company or anyone and float anything. And unless it was just ridiculous, you know, you were given the go ahead.
I never thought I was anything special at all, but they made me feel like I was somebody really special.
Yeah.
And you know, Bob, something I just thought of right now that I really never shared with anybody is I own this house that I'm in right now. I bought a house in 1994, and I would have never been able to buy this house if it wasn't for Russ.
Yeah.
You know, because I couldn't close escrow without coming up with additional income. And I didn't have the additional income that we needed. So I called Russ and I said, is there any way you could come up with this? And it was I didn't want to tell you, I'm so embarrassed, but it was a sizable amount of money.
Yeah.
And I said, can you give me this as a bonus? And as soon as escrow closes, I'll send it right back. And he's like, yeah, no problem. I literally had a check the next day, you know?
Yeah.
And escrow closed. And I'm like, Russ, how do you want me to send this back? And he's like, don't worry about it. And I'm like, don't worry about it. He's like, no, you're just not going to get a Christmas bonus from me ever again. But, you know, don't worry about it. These are the things you can do with Orchid Tower.
You know,
I mean, it's mind blowing.
Yeah. I had a boss who was out with a heart condition, and we had really good insurance and it covered most of it. But I think, you know, they still had a significant amount of money out of pocket. And within a couple of days, a personal check came from Russ to cover that manager's hospital. You know, it's just, he's really, you know, really, really special stuff. So how about, let's talk just about a couple more things as our time's, you know, coming a little bit to a close. After Westwood, you went back to West Covina.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Back
Tell
to where I started. You know, it was a bigger store, had, you know, triple the staff that Westwood had. And
which isn't always a good thing.
No, it was learning to do that differently and building a management team. You know, that kind of volume, you know, you literally, we had buyers, I you know, that these guys that really knew what they were doing. You know, before, you know, the things started becoming central purchased, right?
Yeah.
So it was a different view from being a clerk or and then a shift manager to being the store manager, and a team that's an entirely different team, and they've been under other manager. They don't know who I am and how to you know, find a way to be accepted by them and show them that, you know, that I cared and that I had their best interest in mind. And then to do things, you know, and we started, you know, we did that Tower Latina there. We had a whole store within a store, you know, we branched out into Latin music, and it was a phenomenal success.
Yeah. And was Monica involved in that?
Monica, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd known Monica since she and I were clerks back in the '80s. Together at West Covina. You know, Bob, we never even got into going down to Mexico City and opening the tower stores down there.
Let's talk about that.
That was a lot of fun.
Now, what year was that?
What year was that? Because I believe I was, Bob, I can't remember if I was in Westwood or West Covina. I'm pretty sure I was in Westwood when I went down there.
So mid-90s?
Yeah, and we had a partner, a guy named David West, who was American who lived in Mexico City and who was helping as a partner down there to establish things. You know, there were some great leadership down there. George Perez was the store manager and Dan Luna was down there with them. Both of those guys came from West Covina as well. West Covina launched a tremendous amount of store managers.
Yeah.
Especially because there were so many stores in California. And Lisa Saldana was down there too. And, you know, the working down there was really amazing because all of the Mexican employees were so, so grateful to have this job with an American company, and they were getting paid by, you know, MTS in Sacramento, right?
Right.
They were getting, I think they were getting California minimum wage, which was like more than what their parents were making for some of the kids. And they were such hard workers, and they dressed so nice coming to work every day. And you know, it was an adventure. I remember being outside receiving a shipment as I was working with the receiving team, showing them how things are done. And you know, the corruption in Mexico, right? The boxes were showing up already open, missing stuff. But I remember this guy coming, walking down, and he was a big, I would say a Texan, right? Big American with his cowboy hat. And he's like, "Well, God damn, there's a Tower Records down here. These things are everywhere." That was pretty cool. You know, and you know, Stan had asked me to stay, you know, they wanted to expand and continue going. He's like,
"Yeah,
you know, I'm fluent in Spanish. I have a lot of connections down there." We got booted out of the hotel after the first night because somebody more important showed up and they needed our rooms, you know, and I made a phone call to an aunt who works in the motion picture industry down there. And she hooked us up the next day in another place. Right.
Yeah.
So that was a good asset to have.
Yeah. Did you consider going down? Did you have that discussion with your wife?
They had just helped me buy a house. He was like, "Just give me 5 years down there." And I was like, "Ooh, yeah, we had to have that discussion." But
yeah,
but you know, that didn't pan out. But yeah, West
Covina, Mexican director of operations.
You know, and it stretched all the way. It was Latin American because it was going to stretch all the way down to Argentina.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a deep hunger for the stores down there.
Yeah. So how long were you in Mexico City helping to get that open?
I was just there for a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But I took all the Americans out every night.
Yeah.
I showed them all of Mexico City, and I took them all the way out to the Aztec pyramids.
I opened a bunch of stores. I don't. And again, it's 30 years later. I don't know how we worked all day, drank all night, and then got back at 8 the next morning to do it all over again. I don't know where that part of me is. But yeah, I remember those. That was good.
All the other Americans were like, "What the heck is this Rick guy all about?" Because they, I'm calling their rooms, going, "We got cars down in the street, all here to pick us up. Let's go," you know. And and my family down there had arranged this every night, you know. So my cousins would be down there, and they gave all the Americans a tour of Mexico City nightlife.
That's amazing.
You can't get that just anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, they saw everything from you know, fire breathing people to circus acts to rotating bars in the Zona Rosa. And it was, you know, the midnight knock, getting tequila at 2 a.m. and you know, and singing with mariachis till the sun comes up, and then getting back to the store.
it hurts just thinking about it. So I guess to finish it, you finished where you started. You were there till the bitter end. You know, it was rocky there for a while. Mm-hmm. We hit 2004, and it's extremely rocky. Tell me about your experience with going through the really difficult times and how things ended.
You know, when the bankruptcy decision, the court decision came down, I was up late on a Friday night, and I rolled into my office on Saturday morning, and there was a new guy sitting there, you know, from the liquidation company.
Oh yeah.
A suit sitting in my office. And it was, you know, you could say it's like a gut punch, but it was more than that. I was so hollow.
Yep.
I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. And the worst part is your whole team is looking at you for, you know, help. What do we do? And I felt so helpless to help them.
Yeah.
And I remember we had that first Regis inventory, RGIS inventory. And I was like, what is this? Who are these people in here counting?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That was the first time. So for people listening that don't know, Tower did inventories, but we counted, our people counted our own product. Mm-hmm. It's funny, being in retail after Tower, every other company in the world uses Regis, or there was a company called, I think, Washington Inventory Services. But that was, yeah, that was the first time we had people from the outside counting our product. We had to set it up, but those people, they didn't care anything. They didn't care at all.
Yeah.
The way, you know, as I always said, the only thing I didn't like about Tower was our inventories, because 2 12 hour days, you know, but everything else, it was worth it for everything else, how amazing it was. But our people cared about it, getting the numbers right, and the Regis people just could not care less.
Yeah, I was like, "How this is?"
But so then again, it wasn't our product, so right. But still,
but at that time,
ownership.
It was our store. It was our baby. It was, you know, something we had built and we had nurtured and cherished, and it was gone in that instant, and it was too much to process.
I thought we were going to have a couple of days. Just not that it's fun rehashing one of the worst moments of your life, but I remember I left, it was Friday. I left at 4:30 and I believe an email went out from the main office that said that FYE or Trans World won the auction. I walk out the door, see you guys on Monday. I get home. It took me from Lincoln Center to North Jersey an hour and a half to get home. I get home, I walk through the door and the phone's ringing and it's the store. They didn't get it. The liquidators got it.
Yeah.
That email went out. Just the information was bad. It went out too early. And shortly after, I got a call from my regional, Tim Devon. And he said, I'm going to tell you right now, get into that store as early as you can tomorrow morning. Anything that is your personal thing, so, you know, signed frame posters, your personal computer, get it out of there because they're going to assume it's Tower property.
Yeah.
So I got there at 7 a.m., cleared my office of personal effects, left, and for the next 8 hours, the phone kept ringing and I didn't pick it up because I figured it was one of these great American guys. I went in on Sunday and the guy started giving me a hard time I wasn't home. And it was just, you know how it was going from there. Yeah. It was just a nightmare.
Yeah. This guy tells me, I don't need you to do anything except collect your paychecks and hire me a bunch of people. I was so fortunate that the guy I had doing receiving at the time was pretty sharp about bankruptcy things. And he went into my office and he boxed up everything that was mine, all my artwork on the walls and stuff. And he shipped it to my house.
Yeah.
Cause when I got there on Saturday morning, the guy said, you know, and I had tons of furniture. I had my Ron Miners, our regional, had his office downstairs. All of his furniture was furniture that I had brought from my personal, you know, supply. I had access to a bunch of furniture from a school district that had closed down. So I had desks for everybody, Monica's desk, Ron's desk.
Right.
And we lost all that. They kept everything.
Yeah. They claimed it was Tower property. So yeah, I was grateful for that phone call. That was insane. Well, I don't want to leave on a bummer note. So
no.
Anything that we didn't touch on that you wanted to share?
Bob, there's a ton of stuff that we didn't touch on that I want to share, but you know what? There'll be other episodes, you know, cause I think your podcast is going to do fantastic and there's going to be, you know, more rounds down the road. there's so many staff members that I think I still want to shout out to, and people that went on to other things. You know, so many staff members that were clerks with me, were roommates with me. We had an apartment with like, you know, 10 different tower people living in there. You know, Dan Heikemper went on to be, he's a big shot at, he works at Fender now, but he was a big shot at Warehouse and then Warner Brothers. And Bruno Haddad-Gez was a 16-year-old kid who did DJing for me in Westwood. And he made mixtapes back when, you know, the trance and acid jazz scene was big. And one of his tapes landed on Chris Blackwell's desk, and he gave Bruno a 10 album deal. He founded Quango Records, Bruno.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, fantastic kid. I had, Mike Cano, who worked as my store artist in West Covina, was a phenomenal, Chicano artist from East LA, who's got a lot of renowned, projects behind him and artwork that he did for recording artists, people like Richard Thompson and even Molotov, a Mexican rock band. The list is endless, but there's a family out there that, you know, when eventually Sears figured out that building was something they wanted to raise, you know, it turned into a parking lot there in West Covina. And I got phone calls that just didn't end when they said they're tearing down our building, you know.
Yeah.
There's the love that just continued.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I'm connected with so many people to this day, you know, and it's great. You know, those are things I cherish forever.
Well, it's kind of like I said at the top, like running into you at a Borders convention and just, you know, it's almost like we didn't have to swap stories. There was just this understanding between us, and knowing where we came from and where we did the majority of our groundwork, you know, working for Tower. It was because it was you, and it was Mike Redman was there. And
I forgot Mike was there too. And
Kevin Ertel
and Jeff Myers.
Yeah. So it was funny, but, it really is an unspoken family kind of thing that you talk about. It's very true. So, well, listen, I really, really, I look forward to, our second hour when we do that. I want to thank you for taking the time and for sharing your story. I'm really excited for people to hear your story. It's pretty fascinating. And until the next time, I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Bob. It's been an absolute pleasure and stress-free. So I'm going to tell all my comrades out there in the field, this is a fun thing to do.
Excellent. Well, good.
They got to join you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, Bob, we're signing off, right?
Oh, man, what a great guy. I really enjoyed speaking with Rick Dorsey. So much of what he said, I absolutely related to. I honestly think that if we had actually crossed paths in a store in a region, we would have been longtime record buddies. Again, thank you, Rick. 2500 Del Monte Street, the oral history of Tower Records, is a production of Busy Buzzy Media. A very special thank you to Mike Slow-Mo Brenner for providing our theme music and all original music for our podcast. Mike Brenner has a Patreon page you can join for $5 a month. Go to www.patreon.com/Mike Slow-Mo Brenner. Please subscribe and review our podcast wherever you listen. More importantly, please tell a friend or two about us. Check out our Instagram and Facebook pages at Tower Records Podcast. And don't forget, we have a related Facebook page, Induct Tower Records Russ Solomon into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Bob Zimmerman. Thanks for joining us.